Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here, along with Shab Marquitz. We are your hosts for the weekend edition, also your hosts throughout the week on our website, kereport.com. I also want to focus everybody in that website update that we launched early on this week. We're very excited to have a new and updated website. We're still working through some of the little nuances of the site, so please keep your emails coming. Let Shad and I know what you want to see in the website, any changes that you think would improve the site. We're really just trying to provide an updated platform and help really focus the message and organize the site a bit better in terms of all the different markets that we cover on really a daily basis. On this weekend show, we're going to be focusing a lot, again, on the precious metals, but also, as we always do, taking a big picture look at markets and some other key drivers that I think we all need to be at least cognizant of as we progress through the rest of this year, which Q4 continues to be quite volatile. We are kicking off the show with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Now, Matt, we're going to start with the precious metals, more specifically gold and silver. We are recording this very late in the day on Wednesday. So we can, I guess, announce that Wednesday, very good day for the precious metals as gold moved up closer to $1,800. Silver moved back above $23. Now, look, this pop is encouraging for the precious metals investors, but again, $1,800 gold, we've been talking about that for months, and $23 silver, that's still near the bottom of the range for where silver is traded for about a year now. So, Matt, understanding that these precious metals were washed out along with the stocks even more so, is this bounce and this rally that we have seen over the last few trading days, do you think this is the start of another leg higher?
Well, Corey, firstly, thanks for having me back on the program. It's always good to join you. I don't want to be a wet blanket here, especially because I know you have a strong precious metal contingent amongst your listeners, but I would say most likely not. I do not think that this bounce today, well, it has been nice to see gold up 2% plus and silver at times today up 3% plus. I think it's less likely than not that this is the start of a new leg higher. From my perspective, the market remains fully, firmly entrenched in a risk-on mindset. You're seeing folks within the mining space, you know, flock to metals like uranium. There's a lot of excitement there. But just generally, you have tech stocks still working. You have cryptos creeping back up towards the highs that we saw in spring of 2021. You have this NFT mania that maybe some of your listeners have started to hear about. At least in the United States, real estate prices are still moving higher. So I think across the spectrum, you know, the other portions of folks' portfolios are doing quite well. And I think we're unlikely to see that next move higher in precious metals until we firmly go into a risk-off environment. And it's hard to say when that could happen. It could be later this year. It could be early next year as folks take profits in a new tax year. And it could be in the spring of next year as folks realize that it's more likely than not that we'll have split government after the 2022 midterms. Or maybe this euphoric rally can continue for a bit longer than that. But I think sooner rather than later, we are going to see a shift from this risk on into a decidedly risk off mindset. And, you know, obviously in the immediate aftermath of that, there is the risk of, you know, a final capitulation event. So I think those of us holding precious metals and precious metal equities should be aware of that. You know, that said, from a 2 to 3 year perspective, I think it's a great time to be deploying and accumulating high quality names where, you know, the management, you know, the company stories, you know, their expected milestones, and you're confident that they're going to be able to deliver returns for you as a shareholder. You know, even if precious metals stay largely flat for the foreseeable future, you know, from a more bird's eye view, I do believe that we are in the midst of a longer term precious metals bull market here, whether that started in, you know, late 2015, early 2016 or spring of 2019, I think is up for debate. but I'm still viewing this, you know, firmly as a correction within a broader bull market. You know, and I will say sentiment has been abysmal. It's, you know, improved somewhat in recent days and weeks, but it's been absolutely abysmal for the PM patch. So as a contrarian investor, that gets me a bit more excited about adding to our higher conviction positions. And then really quickly, Corey, you mentioned silver. I do find silver quite interesting. I think investors need to be very careful with how they obtain exposure. You know, absolutely stick to quality names, quality management teams. There are a lot of silver companies where their, you know, the most important merit is that they have silver in their corporate title. So you don't want to go out and buy a broad basket. You want to be very selective with your picks. You know, that said, going back 50 years to the beginning of the 1970s, we actually haven't seen a period where gold has reached an all-time high and silver has not followed within the next 2.5 or 3 years. Sometimes silver follows immediately to an all-time high. Sometimes there's a 2.5 or 3 year lag. But we've not seen that not occur since 1970. Now, of course, this isn't an immutable law of nature. This time could be different. But if recent history repeats, that means we could be seeing $50 silver, you know, 3 years, we'll say, after the August 2020 all-time peak in gold there. So that would return, you know, 120% or so from current levels. And obviously those that have, you know, selected quality silver equities could do even better. So, you know, I don't want to sound like a rabid silver bull, but I think it's an interesting time to be looking at that metal as well.
Yeah, Matt, it is interesting that silver has been lagging gold and being able to break out to a new all-time high, but it does usually play catch up. And if history is any lesson, then we should see some outperformance in both silver and the silver stocks. A question for you, though, you'd brought up the new kind of environment we're in where so many retail investors are interested in the tech and the cryptos and the NFTs and the vaccine stocks. There was a lot of biotech stocks that surged. So there's this appetite for risk on that you were mentioning. And you said that if there was eventually a risk off environment, don't you think that more investors would probably rotate into gold first before they found the mining sector? Or do you think some of these miners, like the producers that are finally starting to produce good revenues and cash flows, and maybe we'll see a little more M&A, could that be a driver that gets some of that hot money looking at the mining stocks again? Or do you think that the sector has fundamentally changed from where it was maybe a decade or two ago, where maybe there's just less interest in the mining stocks in general because of all these other outlets for speculative fervor?
So I will say, I think as an investor, you have to prepare to get punched in the face in the immediate aftermath of a trend reversal there. So just like we saw in March 2020, precious metal stocks, I mean, just look at the GDX and GDXJ there. There were a couple weeks of absolute mayhem, got absolutely destroyed before we went on this, you know, 6 month rip-roaring rally. So, you know, I would assume that process does repeat itself. You know, you could argue that because of the strength in balance sheets of some of these production stage names, I mean, yeah, the gold space as a whole is in pretty doggone good shape here, you know, given that we've been between 2100, I mean, even $1,800 an ounce is a pretty solid price for some of these higher quality production stage names. So, yes, I think it would play out like it generally does. You get hit first. Then folks start trickling into the larger, more liquid names, you know, more of the blue chips within the gold space, and then they start going, you know, further upstream to the development stage names, and then down to expiration, and then silver getting thrown in there as well. But you know, as an investor, this doesn't, you know, have to play out in exactly this manner, and you know, I think. Rather than trying to time the market perfectly, it makes more sense to accumulate names, you know, set some stink bids and see what you can pick up in these coming months.
So Matt, in terms of the most important factors you think to be watching for these companies, look, you're not alone in the sense of it might take some time for maybe a true up leg and a strong bull market up move again to take shape. But looking at companies, what we keep hearing is management. Obviously, that's important. Find management that has had past success. We're also hearing a lot about the importance of having cash in the bank for these companies because, look, a lot of money was raised about a year and a half ago, but there's a lot less being raised right now. Some companies are still raising money, but broadly, there are a few more of the, let's say, lower quality companies coming back to market and not being able to raise money. Is that a key distinction right now, that a company has money to continue working, but also has some extra funds to, let's say, last them at least 2 years, including their work programs?
Yeah, I think that's a key point there, Corey. You know, 2 years is maybe a little bit aggressive, but certainly a year. And I think for names where it becomes obvious to the market that they're going to have to finance in the next 6 to 9 months, you're going to have what's commonly called a financing overhang, where folks, even if they like the story, will instead sit on their hands, wait on the sidelines, and wait for the deal to be announced, you know, hoping to get a discount to market, you know, and or a half warrant or full warrant sweetener along with the deal. You know, I will say, in terms of the industry as a whole, I think there is an allocation issue. And to me, it's pretty striking. I was just looking at Austex Resources, which is Rob Murdoch's newsletter out of Australia, focused specifically on the ASX. And at the moment, just under 40% of ASX-listed resource companies are focused on gold. And the numbers in North America are similar. Last time I checked, it was actually a little bit north of 40% in North America. And so, you know, the junior industry as a whole, we have, you know, 40% plus of juniors focused on gold. You add in silver, you know, we're approaching 50% of all juniors are focused on precious metals. And if you look at the value of gold that's actually pulled out of the ground relative to the rest of the metal space, you know, in a given year, we're only talking 15 to 20% of the value there. So I actually think there's a bit of an allocation issue in the industry as a whole. There's, of course, a certain allure to gold, and I understand that. But I think this just goes to show that you have to be that much more specific, that much more selective with your gold investments. Really take a sniper-like approach. And for MJG, except in very, very rare circumstances, we always want to invest in, you know, assuming good management, good company structure, upcoming catalysts. From a project perspective, we always want to invest in projects where we think value can be created, even if the gold price or, say, the silver price stays flat for the next 3, 4, or 5 years. There are quite a few gold optionality plays out there where you're looking at large CapEx, low grade, low margin projects that have no chance of being built at, you know, $1,700, $1,800 gold, but could absolutely light up a spreadsheet at, you know, $3,000 plus gold. I don't think that's the way to play the space, because there's just so many of these vehicles out there that even when we do get that big move in gold, there's a lot of different mouths to feed. So I think that goes back to your point, Corey. Be very selective, you know, with the companies that you're looking at, and make sure they check all the boxes. As I mentioned, people, project, company structure, healthy working capital for a year plus, and hopefully two, as you said, and catalysts in the calendar to drive value, even if we don't see an immediate move in the metal price.
Well, Matt, some great points there and some good tips for investors. So I appreciate you sharing that with us. And you mentioned the allocation mismatch. So obviously there's more to the world and resources than just gold and silver. So let's talk about some of the other markets. One that's really has been lighting up the boards lately is the uranium sector. And some of that is on the back of the news of the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust going in and buying up with their at-the-market fundings and buying up uranium out of the spot market. But a lot of the miners have been honestly moving for the last year and a half, way before that. Some of that on the Strategic Reserves United States narrative. Some of that was on the front-running of the eventual contracting cycle starting up again. But what we've actually seen over the last year and a half is huge runs in the uranium stocks. And it didn't really matter whether they were quality companies or whether they had a wing and a prayer of getting into production in this cycle. Almost the whole sector has run up. So my question, Matt, is at this point, after the rally we've just seen really over the last month or two, another leg higher, do you think things are getting a little bit too frothy here? And in the uranium sector, is there an area that you like more than the other between the producers, the developers, the explorers? What do you make of this recent run higher in the uranium sector?
Sure. Well, as a metal, I really love uranium, actually. I mean, it's the only, it's the feed source to the only form of power aside from hydropower, but there's fewer and fewer rivers to dam these days, you know, putting aside environmental concern. But the only form of power that can operate 24/7 around the clock without any CO2 emissions. So I think, and especially with this decarbonization push that I think is to continue in the years and decades ahead, there's going to, of course, be some pushback as we go along the way, especially if it results in higher energy prices. But I think decarbonization is here to stay. I mean, uranium is absolutely a 21st century metal. And so I think if folks want to play the metal themselves, it could make a lot of sense to buy SPUT, the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, or to buy Yellowcake, which is the, you know, London listed equivalent. In terms of the equities, though, I would be extremely cautious, particularly in this kind of frothy or even euphoric environment that you mentioned. Soon after Sprott finished its takeover of Uranium Participation Corp, we saw a rip-roaring rally in the uranium spot price, rising from the low 30s to quickly above 50. It's pulled back a little bit here, but now we're seeing kind of the animal spirits reemerge. So equities-wise, you know, as an investor, I think especially when we go to this risk-off period that we touched on previously in the interview, folks that are positioned in the more speculative names are at risk of absolutely getting killed, just due to the speculative premium that's built into a lot of these exploration and earlier stage development stage projects. So, you know, looking at uranium, I guess a few insights or potential tips for listeners. I at MJG, we're avoiding exploration entirely. The bar these days to an economic discovery in uranium is so incredibly high, not to mention the massive permitting weight that ensues after you make a discovery. But there's so many undeveloped pounds that are sitting in the ground, discovered and moving along the development curve, that from my perspective, focusing on uranium exploration is a losing game. And there will be the odd winner or two, but as a whole, that's a space that we're avoiding entirely. Second point here, and I alluded to it a little bit, but permits. Permitting in uranium and having an actual mining permit in hand is really more valuable than perhaps for any other metal. So if you're looking at a development stage name and it doesn't already have a permit in hand, or it's not expecting one imminently, from my perspective, it then makes sense to just go for the very best development stage project. So why not just go to NextGen at that point? If you don't have if your development stage project and you don't have a permit, then it's you're in a tough spot, and it can be years or even decades to get there. And so, you know, our large uranium position in the portfolio is permitted and ready to go. And there are a couple names out there that share that distinction. So I think that's something that investors are perhaps underweighting in this environment, when you have kind of unsophisticated non-mining folks charging into the space and buying really anything with uranium in the corporate title. And, you know, the third point, and this echoes some of my feedback from earlier in this interview, but it's to stay disciplined. I mean, again, this name that we own in the portfolio, and I've mentioned it publicly in previous interviews, it's Global Atomic, not a recommendation to your listeners, mind you. But that project works at spot uranium prices. You know, I think if you want to get a little bit greedy as you're plugging numbers into your spreadsheet, you can assume 50, 55, maybe $60 uranium. But I'd really urge folks not to go overboard and not assume uranium prices any higher than $60 per pound. I could be very wrong here. The supply lag as prices move higher could take longer than folks expect. And, you know, uranium does have that sex appeal. And we saw, you know, back in 2005, 2006, 2007, it can go on pretty tremendous runs. But from my perspective, it's better to be more conservative, assume no higher than $60 uranium for the foreseeable future. And if we're surprised to the upside, then great. But I don't think you want to get too greedy in this environment. And again, just to reiterate the first point, be aware that, you know, this is not a contrarian space at the moment. It simply isn't. And when the market turns and we go risk off, some of these more speculative names are going to fall, you know, 50% plus. So investors should keep that in mind.
Final quick comment regarding uranium sector. You even said maybe just focus on these de-risk projects, the ones that should either be moving into production or should be a near-term takeout target, because they are quite defined. NextGen being a great example of that. Matt, when do you think any of these takeovers are going to happen? Because in all fairness, we've seen more majors cutting supply than actually going out there and spending large amounts of money to bring on more supply.
Oh yeah, that is the $64,000 question, Corey, as they say. You know, I don't have any particular timetable on additional consolidation within the uranium space. I do think within the United States, there's one or two consolidators out there that are hoovering up plays. So kind of some of these smaller names, we might see consolidation. But in terms of the high quality projects, you know, whether it's NextGen's Arrow up in the Athabasca Basin or Global Atomic, as I mentioned, their DASA project in Niger. You know, I think there are suitors out there. When will both sides come to the table and make an agreement? I think that's anybody's guess. But I don't expect on the NextGen front, I don't expect the current management team to ultimately be taking that project into production. I might be proven wrong, but that's the assumption. On the DASA front, it's the reverse. I think there is a chance of a takeout before we see first production there. But my assumption is that the current management team is going to take the project into production either on a standalone basis or probably more likely with a toll milling agreement with Orano to start.
Just one more quick one on uranium, Matt, and that is, you know, there's a big anticipation of the longer term contracting cycle starting with the utility companies. I think a lot of that could have been potentially priced in at this point. And like you're saying, most companies that are going to produce, whether they were a prior producer or a developer that's near term, and six or seven of them also bought uranium out of the spot markets themselves so that they could actually start this beginning contracting cycle. If they do come to the table, utility companies, and they, let's say it's 55 or 60 bucks, and they say, okay, we'll go ahead and do a 5 to 7 year agreement with you or longer, do you think that would cap the move up that we've seen and potentially cause a reversal at that point where the production's now coming online, the dozen or so companies that can produce will, and then all the remaining, you know, 40, 50 companies have maybe overdone it? Or do you think that actually would spur the next leg higher?
I think I would lean towards the former. I think the producers out there would be happy to contract large amounts of their uranium in the price ranges that you talked about. And, you know, names like Global Atomic make, you know, they're excellent returns at $55 or $60 uranium. You know, I do think we'll see contracting occur maybe a little sooner than it would have otherwise due to the price action and the spot markets that SPUT's entrance to the scene has provided. I think that's been a bit of a come to Jesus moment for some of these utilities. So yeah, stay tuned on that front.
All right, Matt, let's shift over one final market and one market that we have not talked about. Well, I don't know when the last time we talked about it was, but it's the phosphate market. You shared with us off mic that in, well, your recent MJG investor letter, you're showing a healthy weighting towards phosphate. Why now? Why phosphate? What attracts you there?
Good. Well, I love talking phosphate, but I will say, Corey, the reason we have a large weighting towards phosphate, I found an individual opportunity that I liked, really independent of the metal. You know, it was a development asset, stage asset that I've known for nearly a decade. That was trading at 20 cents on the dollar to historical expenditures, and at over 95% discount to the project's NPV in past economic studies, and also to the, you know, valuation garnered in the last ag minerals cycle. So it's a severely discounted asset. With a management team that's very well incentivized, 20 plus percent insider ownership, actually closer to 30%, and a team that I've also known for quite some time. And then there's catalysts in the calendar and enough cash in the bank to get through those potential catalysts. So this had much more to do with the company specific bet than it did you know, anything to do with phosphate. That said, I do find phosphate to be quite an interesting mineral to be looking at the moment. You know, some of your listeners may be aware, it's one of the three key ingredients towards inorganic fertilizer. potash, which is also a bulk material similar to phosphate, being the second, and then nitrogen being the third. So these are essential for the inorganic fertilizer being used to fertilize our fields globally. Interestingly, from a geological perspective, phosphate is 10 times more rare in the Earth's crust than potash. And additionally, it's much less geographically diversified than potash. In fact, 75% of known phosphate reserves globally sit within Morocco, which is pretty insane when you think about it. I mean, Saudi Arabia is known as the king of oil, and current numbers have them at around 70% of global oil reserves. So we're talking, you know, significantly more from more of a dependence on Morocco, and even more so, a good amount of this phosphate that sits within Morocco is actually within Western Sahara, which is a contested territory. In recent months, there's been live firefights between, you know, rebel groups in the area that think they should have autonomy, and the Moroccan military. And, you know, there's potential there for supply disruptions, you know, if the world or the UN or some of these NGOs start pushing that angle farther. So, again, very much reliant on Morocco for a source of supply. You know, it's been a good, and you mentioned this, we haven't, there's been very little chatter about ag minerals here, really for the past 13 or 14 years. You know, the last big ag mineral boom occurred in the late stages of, you know, the 2002 to 2007 China-driven commodity bull market. And there's been very little speculation and very little investment in exploration and development for either of these bulk materials in the years since. And, you know, I will say, and again, history does not have to repeat itself, but usually once, you know, per every proper commodity bull market, you do see these ag minerals catch investors' attention. And the narrative itself can actually be very intoxicating. I mean, at the end of the day, we do have to eat. And I think folks are already starting to recognize that global food prices have been moving higher in really a V-shaped fashion, you know, really since the aftermath of the March 2020 COVID bust. And, you know, this is kind of the next logical place for speculators to potentially go here. And I'll add finally, you know, there are very few phosphate juniors out there in North America. There's just a handful of them. And this tells us a couple things. I mean, the first is that if/when there are major capital flows back into this space, it could lead to some pretty significant moves. Because, you know, unlike the gold space, where 40% of juniors out there are focused on the metal, there's just so few speculative vehicles at the moment. And I think it also just tells you generally that we're in the earlier stages of this ag mineral cycle. And, you know, when we start to see a new potash or new phosphate junior minted out of Vancouver every you know, month or every few weeks, that probably tells us that we're closer to the time to take profits, if not at the time to take profits. But that's simply not the case right now. So, you know, again, I would not encourage any investor out there to buy a basket of juniors to speculate in a specific commodity. I think it has to make sense on a company specific basis. You know, that said, I think there is a tailwind to the ag minerals generally and phosphate specifically, and there's not been a lot of chatter about it recently. However, that may change. Just a couple weeks ago, it was confirmed that the Chinese government had ordered all state-owned phosphate producers and other phosphate privately owned phosphate producers in country to freeze all exports outside of China, which is an interesting development, through mid-2022. So that's going to apply pressure on phosphate pricing, you know, might bring some eyes over to the space. And then the next big question is, you know, what happens in summer of 2022? Does this export ban continue, or do we see exports resume? So that's something for folks to watch.
Well, Matt, just one more quick comment on the fertilizer space. You know, for a while, we saw a lot of speculation in the potash names, and there was another wave of it maybe a few years back, and then it all filtered out because there was just too much supply coming online, and there was too much capex needed to bring on some of the larger projects. You've outlined the case brilliantly for the phosphate advantage, but do you still see any potential room for some of those potash companies to come back on people's radars as we're seeing inflation in the marketplace, as we're seeing food costs go up, and obviously with more mouths to feed in the world, we're going to need fertilizer? Do you think that there's room for some of the potash names to move as well?
Potentially. There's more of them out there, though, than the phosphate names, kind of an order of magnitude more. And I also, at least through MJG, we also have exposure to potash already through Altius Minerals. So in my mind, that's currently the best way to play potash if you want to do so. Altius is obviously very well diversified across really the commodity spectrum, sands, precious metals. They even have a little bit of precious metals exposure, but they focus outside of there. But I think if you subtract out the value of the company's Labrador iron ore holdings, their prospect generation portfolio, their Altius renewable royalty shares, and their net cash position, you're left with a pretty small enterprise value relative to an incredible royalty portfolio. And I mean, you can ask Brian Dalton, the company's CEO himself, if he could only keep one of his royalties and had to sell the rest of them, it would be the Saskatchewan based potash royalties covering Nutrien and Mosaic mines that he would hold on to. So I think not the majority, but close to the majority of the company's royalty portfolio, or at least the net asset value of that royalty portfolio, can be reasonably attributed to these potash assets, excuse me. And from a portfolio construction perspective, because we already have that exposure and, you know, have the potential to increase our positioning in Altius further, I'm a little less interested in the junior potash angle at the moment.
All right, Matt, great having you on the show, buddy. Really appreciate you taking the first two segments and sharing your thoughts on the precious metals and also some of the other sectors that one you're avoiding and the other that you have gone into thanks to an attractive company. Always great chatting with you, Matt, and we will be having you back on in about a month's time. In the meantime, I hope you have a great rest of your weekend. And hey, Matt, again, thanks for all your insights.
Thanks, Corey. Thanks, Dad.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.